the Therapeutic Alliance reminds people, oh, this is the human experience. I am one person out of many going through these situations, and there's already one person on my side. So if I have one person on my side, I can keep building that arsenal of support.
Welcome to LoveLink, your guide to love and connection in all forms. We're your hosts, Simone Humphrey and Sina Simon. Today we'll be talking to Tess Hochberger, the newest member of the Modern Mind team. She's a therapist specializing in couples and sex therapy, gender identity, and neurodivergence. She's here to talk to us about the epidemic of loneliness that exists in our culture and what we can do to feel more connected in our lives. If you're interested in setting up an appointment with Tess, please reach out to info@modernmind.co. That's info@modernmind.co.
Welcome back to LoveLink, Tess. It's so good to have you here with us.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be back.
So today we're going to talk about loneliness, which I'm really excited to have this conversation because I think this is a really relevant and important conversation that we're starting to have more of, but we're also starting to really see the impact on mental health. And we're excited to pick your brain because this is something that we know you have a lot of interest in and you have a background in. And so before we start kind of delving into what loneliness is and how we get to loneliness, I'm interested in what led you to your interest and your focus and your work with loneliness.
Yeah, thank you for asking. I actually started doing research in loneliness in the geriatric population in about 2017. And at that time, reports were showing that people over 65 were reporting the highest rates of loneliness. And during COVID, which is when we really saw this shift starting to happen, we're now seeing that people reporting the highest rates of loneliness are in their 20s. And I'm in my 20s. I went to grad school in my 20s, and I see it in my peers. And now I see in clinical work, as I'm working with couples in their 20s and 30s, as well as individual adults, we're seeing this really high rate of loneliness occur. And we're seeing that these people are coming in with anxiety and depression. And what I'm seeing through my work is that at the core of these symptoms is this experience of loneliness, even though we're constantly surrounded by people. We're with our friends, we're with our spouses, and we're in constant touch with people around us through social media. We're never alone, yet we're always feeling this sense of loneliness, and it's really spiking rates of social anxiety and depression.
Well, Tess, this is a really important topic, and I'm glad that you're bringing it to us, that you wanted to do this interview where we're focusing on loneliness, because it's pretty pervasive. So maybe to start us off, we can define loneliness. So it's a sadness because of a perceived gap between the desire for social connection and then how people experience their level of social connection. And it can be because of their life circumstances that, you know, people actually are more isolated, and we can talk about that. And it can also be related to more of an internal feeling of not being connected to other people. And that could, we'll also talk about that, but that can be because of a lack of vulnerability in their relationships, a lack of emotional connection for some reason. And it can be both at the same time. But again, important that it's the perceived gap, because some people need a lot of social connection. Some people need less of it. But when there's this gap between the desire for connection and the experience, that's when it becomes a problem. And a lot of the time people are coming into therapy with feelings of anxiety or depression. And really what's underneath that is a feeling of social isolation and loneliness. And that's really what we're working with in therapy, right? This undoing aloneness. So this feeling of loneliness can actually be one of the main reasons that people seek therapy, because it's really a primal need. We need other people. We need to feel socially connected.
Yeah, it makes me think of the worst form of torture, which we know is putting people in social isolation. When people right. are alone for days, weeks on end, we become psychotic. We lose our minds. So we absolutely are wired and need that connection. And it's interesting too that I appreciate how you've defined it, Sina, as perceived loneliness rather than objective, because I think probably, and I'd be curious, Tess, what you've seen, but there is certainly the aspect of it where you're actually oftentimes in literal isolation. And I think that that's increased during COVID. It definitely increases when you're on social media all the time, but that also can happen even when you live with someone and you're with that person all the time, which was what's something I really saw during COVID when I had this influx of couples coming to treatment, talking about their loneliness in isolation with their spouse, because it really felt like they lost their communities and there was a real disconnection and a lot of conflict with their partner, which led to feeling really alone in a tiny environment, tiny quarters with each other.
Right. I was going to make a similar comment about how that perceived loneliness is so key to this conversation, because I'm thinking about, you know, expectations and how when we set expectations and they're broken, that's one of the primary reasons that I see people come into sessions feeling so disappointed or feeling these grand emotions of sadness and loneliness, because we are in constant touch with these curated visions of what other people's connections with loved ones, with friends, with spouses, what those look like to other people. But we're getting short snippets of these stories on social media. And when we have that, and then our real world experience doesn't match up to these expectations, it feels even bigger of a break from society or from ourselves, even when we go into these interactions hoping for something so much more, but feeling like there's a barrier between us and those around us.
Yeah, it makes me think about how free people must have, this is my own projection, how free people must have felt, you know, pre-cell phones, pre-internet, because we're so wired to compare ourselves to other people, and there just weren't as many opportunities to do those comparisons. Like now when we open our phones, there are, I don't know, I have 1,000 friends. What? I don't know all these people. And I'm like seeing these lives, and there are many, many more people to compare myself to, right? Whereas before, maybe it was just like 10.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, social media seems to play a big role in all of this. And I'm wondering, Tess, if you can elaborate on how you understand the flip-flop between the geriatric population being the number one lonely group and now young adults being the number one lonely group. Like what happened? Even in the last 5 years.
Right. There's so much historical and cultural context to be taken into account with this conversation. That shift was starting to happen after the intergenerational family home started to shift, and we started to see both the older adults, so that would be like grandparents, being put into assisted living facilities and being separated from their nuclear family that used to be there for conversation, there for assistance whenever they needed, with this deep connection, this familial connection. And as we think about it, they're actually now being placed into these homes where they're given this inherent community that they're surrounded by 24/7. But at the time, we weren't being given the tools to provide that source of connection to these people being put into facilities. At this point, we're seeing the rate shift to those in their early 20s specifically. And it's my experience through my own clients in clinical work, as well as through some of the research that I've done. But COVID and social media do play massive roles in this shift. We saw people get so comfortable working in their own space, not going into the office, finishing up college and having to shift from being surrounded by the people that you're closest with to being home alone or back with your parents. And it takes us back to this idea of comparison. As we're all doing that, we're on our phones 24/7. We're looking at what other people are doing with those around them and comparing our own lives to those people on the screen. At the same time, we're seeing that drastic shift from being in college, being surrounded, literally surrounded by your friends and peers 24/7. And then, like I was saying, just all of the sudden shifting to either living alone and working a 9-to-5 job or moving to a new state where you don't know anyone. And we're, as a society, moving away from shared spaces. And shared spaces are where you get to go and relax and just kind of run into people and have casual conversation that builds those interpersonal skills. And when we don't have that, this muscle is atrophying more and more as time goes on, especially for people who graduated out of college during COVID or were in the last years of college during the pandemic.
It also makes me think about how quickly it really atrophies. Like, I'm sure, I mean, this is true for me, and I know this is a common experience, when you don't see anyone just for a day, like you're just at home alone for a day and you come out and you meet a group of people at a dinner, it can be an awkward shift into seeing people again. It's like when we don't use our social interaction skills regularly, we start to lose the competency around it. And then the more you lose that capacity, the less you feel motivated to do it, and the more you isolate. And then the more you isolate, the more it's uncomfortable, the more anxious you get, and it becomes this compounded spiral into just feeling isolated and as a result, lonely. So if you don't use it, you lose it.
Exactly. That's so tied into something I see with a lot of my individual clients as well, actually. This notion that they come into session and I hear, I'm exhausted all the time from so many different people. And it's this exhaustion that sits with us because of work, because of staying home, because of all of our tasks that we as an individualistic society place value on doing on our own. And when we're that exhausted, the idea of feeling like I need to go make plans and I need to make them really fun activities and they have to be in new places with new people, it places all of this extra weight on this work that we're doing. And then making plans with those around you tends to become like another checkbox on the to-do list rather than something where we go find refuge with the people that we're closest with, right?
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how our culture plays a role in this. I mean, we live in a very individualistic culture in the United States, very capitalistic culture, and how that plays into the extreme loneliness that we're seeing.
Definitely. As you said, we live in an individualistic culture, and if we're placing all of this value on high success, doing things on your own, dealing with emotions on your own, it becomes more stigmatized to share experiences, or negative specifically, negative experiences with those around you. And like Simone said, if you're not doing it all the time, it gets harder and harder. And so in our society, getting the next job that pays more is that goal for so many people. And a lot of the time that means moving to new places, further away from the people that we're comfortable with, that we've known for so long. And that compounded with moving to places where you're just going to be working remote a lot of the time is so isolating, and it just becomes harder to create community around you wherever you go, because we have this notion going back to social media that everybody already has community. Everybody is already connected somehow. And it's this notion that we're all being othered by this culture. We're all feeling like I'm the only one who's experiencing this. And when there's any situation when you're feeling that, it's going to be that much harder to go find someone who you can talk to about it.
Yeah, it makes me think about like two pieces, like the way that we've shifted our values from collectivist, from, you know, whatever, 1,000 years ago, to the value of success, being self-made, doing it on your own, living on your own, living a life of freedom, living in an area where there's no one around you. I mean, all of these things that are very individualistic. And then also to your point, feeling that isolation and actually having a negative impact. And then on top of it, feeling inadequate, like you shouldn't be feeling that way. So then there is like this kind of meta experience of shame and like you're failing, right? So it's like the combination of here's this drive to be a certain way. And then when you're actually that way and you're unhappy, well, then you failed at doing it.
Right. And young men, they've done all these studies about like who's the loneliest in our culture. And it's always young men. And it makes sense because they're the ones who are most at the mercy of this pressure to be successful. They're just at the beginning of their career and they're all socialized out of vulnerability for the most part. I mean, we see this in our therapy practices all the time, how it can be really difficult for a lot of men to be in a space of vulnerability, which would allow them to be able to connect with other people.
So Tess, what's the impact of loneliness on people's health? How does it affect people?
We're seeing a direct correlation to decline in physical health as well as mental health in those who report higher rates of loneliness. The U.S. Surgeon General even made note in 2020 that they're seeing earlier mortality in those who are experiencing high levels of loneliness in their adulthood. We're also seeing that people are significantly more likely to struggle with substance abuse and depression and anxiety if they're experiencing higher levels of loneliness as well.
Yeah, there's a great study of rats where they isolate rats by themselves and then they put rats in groups in a tank and they see that rats who are by themselves exhibit signs of depression, but also abuse substances. They'll put cocaine in their water and rats will become addicted who are isolated. And rats who are socialized and with other rats, it actually is a buffer and protects them against addiction. So it's so interesting how this is shown in rodents, but also the same is true for humans. And we know that with substance abuse treatment, a lot of it is around social connection, things like AA, being with friends, like that this is a huge protective factor.
It speaks to the internal distress that people experience when they're lonely, like that they then have to use substances to such an extent that they become addicted, right, in order to regulate themselves. And that when they enter into spaces, right, like you're saying, like AA or, you know, just being reconnected with other people, that can have a really regulating effect.
We also see even just like how people talk about, you know, to have a more productive day, get out and face the sun to get those vitamins in the morning, and it impacts the rest of your day. We're also seeing that having some sort of social interaction with someone you're comfortable with, or even going to have a conversation with the person who's giving you a cup of coffee down the street, has a sincerely positive effect on the outcome of the rest of your day. It impacts your confidence, the work that you do, how you move throughout the day. So there's so much that happens behind the scenes just from having these short bursts of interpersonal interaction.
Which I never knew until I experienced COVID, right? Because I was never in a situation where I wasn't around people. And then during COVID, you realize how valuable those interactions with strangers are, that actually community doesn't just exist with close-knit people in your life. The community also comes from walking in the neighborhood or going to your local cafe or seeing the person at the register at a grocery store. I mean, all of these things really nourish us, but seem very innocuous when you don't notice it.
Right. There's something so validating about having a conversation with someone, whether you previously knew them or not. If you can smile or get a smile from someone else throughout your day, that immediately goes into your confidence and how you think about yourself, and in turn, how you think about the world around you and how they're responding to you. And when you know that the world around you is perceiving you as a positive entity in the community, you have this boost that takes you throughout the day, this confidence boost that kind of pulls you along.
Hi, LoveLink listeners. Our group practice, Modern Mind, is located in New York City with offices in Brooklyn and Manhattan, offering in-person and virtual psychotherapy. We provide individual, couples, and group therapy, as well as ketamine-assisted psychotherapy in conjunction with a psychiatry prescriber. Therapy is a powerful experience that can transform your life and help you live it to its full potential. We're here to help take you where you want to go. To find out more about our practice, visit www.modernmind.co. or email info@modernmind.co to be connected with one of our therapists.
I'm curious also what your thoughts are, because we know that if we use social media, it leads to loneliness. What about when you are lonely? Like, what's the impact that does that have on social media use? Like, do we see that people who are lonely tend to use social media more? I mean, I know it's probably really hard to parse out, but I'm just curious about your thoughts on screen time when you are lonely.
Right. This is that cyclical factor of loneliness, right? The more lonely we are, the more we turn into ourselves and we turn to things like social media, scrolling, watching more movies and TV shows. And it's really about being intentional about the way that you use social media. From what I see with my clients and even my peers and myself, right? If you're walking into, you know, Instagram or TikTok and you're thinking of it as a comparison of my life to others, you're immediately othering yourself, like I had said before. And when you do that, you're raising your expectations in a way that is not parallel to your life. It's parallel to or mirroring someone else's life that can be completely different than what you have around you. But if you're using social media to maybe join a community and there is some outcome in that community, there's meetups happening, or this is a group where you can talk about a shared interest, you then get to experience that social interaction where you're having the empowerment of having input for someone else, and people are also sharing their experience with you, rather it just being a doom scroll of watching other people's lives for hours on end, right? And that's where the comparison is really harmful for us.
So let's talk a little bit about how to treat loneliness and what people can actually do to combat loneliness. I'm curious, outside of the therapy room, what advice you would have for people about how they can deal with loneliness, deal if they notice them coming up.
I think that one thing that starts with introspection actually is figuring out what you truly enjoy doing, what you enjoy talking about, and again, being intentional about the spaces that you walk into, about the communities you're trying to be a part of. Community building feels like another to-do list task to check off, but the more you do it, the more you use that muscle, the more empowering it gets, and the more you get to experience different types of worlds, different experiences. And that work in itself, being intentional about that work, not only decreases loneliness, but it empowers you and your confidence, and you start to realize more about yourself, and you start to be more of an authentic person.
I love that. I love this idea of intentionality too, because I think the problem with being addicted to screens is that it's a default. And actually, oftentimes we don't even realize we're doing it. We numb ourselves to the point of not recognizing its impact on our health. And so I think probably the first step is just to wake up a little bit, wake up to how you've checked out and that you are even experiencing loneliness. Like, what does loneliness feel like inside of you? Knowing, okay, it's this longing for connection, or maybe it's this feeling of low self-worth, or maybe it's this real sadness, like a lethargy. I think for a lot of people, it's actually just numbness. Like you're not even in touch with sadness because you're so checked out. So being able to see, okay, maybe it's social media that I've just been looking at after work for a couple of hours, or maybe it's eating all this junk food or takeout, or maybe it's realizing that I haven't made friends with plans in weeks on end and I question my relationships. But just being able to see, okay, this is a problem in my life. Let me think about what you're speaking to, which is what brings me joy. What do I need to do with my life to turn that around?
And sometimes it requires people really being intentional about taking space. Like, what happens if you take an hour to yourself to just sit with yourself and journal or think, no screens? What are the feelings that you get in touch with in that space? Right. Just to your point, if we're totally numbed out, it's hard to even access any feelings.
Exactly. Sina, I had such a similar thought with that, this idea that if we don't give a give ourselves permission to rest and take a step back when it's needed, then we're going to burn out. We're going to feel that overwhelm when we're in community or surrounded by other people because we're not ready for that. And then if we're not ready, we're not doing what makes us feel good. We're not being authentic. We're not speaking our true mind. And then you leave those interactions with those ruminating thoughts, which we see a lot with clients, especially who have anxiety, right? Did I say the right thing? I was too tired for that interaction, right? And so really slowing down and thinking, do I have energy for this? How can I prepare myself to be who I want to be in this social interaction? And then we're, again, being intentional with these interactions that empower us rather than drain us and tend to make us feel more lonely by the time we get home.
How can you prepare to be in connection with people when you're feeling really anxious and avoidant, right? Like I know there's so many times when I have plans to meet up with people and I feel exhausted or I feel this sense of dread or I don't want to. And then I do it and it feels really good, but how can you prepare for that? Or what if you're feeling really anxious and you don't want to? What can you do about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things that I do with a lot of my clients, actually, I love mindfulness breathing. I think taking a moment to shut off your mind from those racing thoughts about work, about everything else that's going on in the world around us right now, to take a moment to silence that and feel grounded in your own body. If you're feeling like one foot in and one foot out of your body, then you're not able to focus on what's going on inside your own brain, let alone with the people who you're going to spend time with. And that, again, you're feeling even othered from yourself. And that causes a lot of stigma or pressure that we're putting on ourselves. So taking the time to breathe through those moments, whether it's breathing, yoga, I know people who do dancing in their own room by themselves or going on a run, whatever works for you to separate your brain from the ruminating thoughts so that you can be present in your own body is so key for those moments.
Yeah, that's so important, just being regulated.
Yeah, and I also love that because then you can also tune into maybe you really do need a night to yourself. Maybe actually what your body is telling you is time alone. And there's a very big difference between loneliness and being alone.
Exactly.
Right? Like sometimes we need the opposite. Sometimes we really need to take care of ourselves without other people around.
And sometimes it's about asking that anxious part, because it is a part, to step aside and say, okay, but is there another part that then shows up that says, oh, actually I want to be connected. It's going to feel really good on the back end, or like just doing it. But right, discerning if you need time for yourself because that's nourishing versus you're being avoidant. That's an important distinction.
Right. It requires that introspection of being able to separate these differing parts of our minds and of our bodies. How can I move forward? What is my body trying to tell me right now? And am I giving myself permission to listen to my own cues versus going with the flow, giving into what's being asked of me always? Which is what I see with a lot of our people pleasers, right? Myself included. I sometimes tend to push forward for too long, and then we feel that burnout, that social burnout. So the more introspective you can get and the more permission you give yourself to rest when it's needed and then go socialize when you have energy for it is so important for this process of diminishing loneliness.
I think also for a lot of people, maybe not the people pleasing type, but for a lot of people, like really being intentional with friendships. Like if you want to be connected to people, you have to invest in people. Like you have to, you know, if you make a dinner date with somebody, don't just cancel every time, right? Like, or call the people in your life that you love, like invest in those people and you will get that back. But like sitting back and expecting something to happen and people to come to you automatically is not going to work. Like you really have to put in effort.
That makes me think about the difference between having a very connected, small social group versus a really large social circle who with people that you don't feel intuitively connected to, and how those large groups are often the places we tend to feel most lonely. And the small, very close-knit groups are where we feel the most seen, the most heard, and the most connected.
What does this look like in the therapy room? Like, how do we treat loneliness therapeutically?
I think going to what we've been speaking to about social media, being intentional and limiting that screen time that we have, and investing, being intentional with our relationships and our friendships. And I think a lot of this work starts with us on our own. It starts with taking a deeper look at what are my needs? What are my desires? Am I feeling fulfilled with the people around me? And in that, we start to see answers of, this is what I actually need more of. Can I really invest in these people, in these types of communities that will serve me?
Yeah, definitely. And I also think about the value of the therapeutic relationship between the patient and the therapist. Like, that relationship in itself can undo a lot of aloneness. You know, when people have a space to feel vulnerable, to be seen with somebody, that can be a first step in it being able to bring that vulnerability out into their lives and being able to connect with other people. It first starts with the therapist. Or even with couples, you know, where it doesn't become so much about, it's not about connecting with the therapist, it's about two people connecting with each other and how the therapist creates a context and helps support vulnerability in both people.
Yeah, and it's what makes the relationship with a therapist so different than a friendship, because of course friendships are powerful and can be very healing, but I think therapeutic presence is very different because the relationship is all about holding space and supporting the client in a really objective way. And that witness in having someone who's validating, who creates safety, who allows you to explore parts of yourself that you can be really scared to explore on your own, and then seeing the darkest places. I mean, this is the work that we do with trauma, really being able to undo that aloneness, really hold that person's hand and say, this is what you went through and I'm right here. And I think that that's possible to do in friendships, but it just looks very different. And I think that that's really, that can be the most powerful piece of therapy, is being just fully present for another person.
I could not agree more. That alliance sits in the center of this conversation. Having someone who you know for a fact is there to hold your vulnerability in their hands and keep it safe for you while you're processing the scary parts of thinking that you don't know how to talk about to the people who you have close relationships in your life with yet, it takes out so much of the fear of being alone or being othered by the people in your life. And the therapeutic alliance reminds people, oh, this is the human experience. I am one person out of many going through these situations, and there's already one person on my side. So if I have one person on my side, I can keep building that arsenal of support.
It reminds me of this children's book called Here We Are that I read to my kids sometimes, where on the last page, it talks about how you're never alone on Earth. It's really sweet. But just that idea that, like, there's always, like you're speaking to, Tess, like there's always someone. And I think when you get hooked up with a good therapist, you can feel that, hey, okay, here's one person. And then, expand from there.
Exactly. Ugh, I think that adults have so much to learn by going back and reading children's books. I love those moments. It's that creative analogy of seeing our very intense individualistic world as, oh, if we're all going through these experiences, why are we all doing it by ourselves? We have these people who are here to support us, and we just sometimes need the confidence to go out and ask for support from those people.
And simplify. I feel like so much of my role as a therapist is just simplifying and organizing people's experiences. And that in of itself is both clarifying, but also regulating and connecting. And that's what we're really looking for. We're looking for, you know, that feeling of being deeply connected to another person like we were when we were children or babies in our mother's womb. You know, yeah. I think we're just like scratching to get back to that place. And
exactly.
It's never quite going to happen, but there's ways to build that in.
Well, thank you so much, Tess. This has been a really wonderful conversation, and I think people will get a lot out of it.
Thank you so much. I always appreciate your questions and insight on these topics.